Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing it, and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're gonna get Amin in those, so you gotta listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Hey, listener, Underdog Fantasy is the easiest place to play fantasy sports. Also, the fastest growing fantasy app in the industry. You can play Pick'em, pick whether your favorite players will have a higher or lower total in each stat for this week's games for a chance to win big. You can actually win up to 100 times your money in a single night. That's right. I didn't say 10. I didn't say 20. Up to 100 times your money. Pick between 2 and 5 players, build a pick 'em entry. My favorite feature, you can make rivals picks. Pit 2 players against each other. Wembanyama versus Nikola Jokic. Tim Hardaway Jr. versus Norm Powell. Kawhi Leonard versus Steph Curry. Who knows? Maybe Grayson Allen versus Pat Connaughton. You get where I'm going with that. You can do it all with Underdog Fantasy. Make sure you sign up today with the promo code DING. That's D-I-N-G. And get your first deposit doubled up to $100, as well as an instant pick'em special. Visit underdogfantasy.com or find them in the app store. And don't forget to register with our promo code DING, D-I-N-G, to get your first deposit doubled up to $100, as well as an instant pick'em special. Must be 18 or older and present in a state where Underdog Fantasy operates. Terms apply. Concerned with your play? Call 1-800-522-4700 or visit www.ncpgambling.org.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest edition of the Woke Bros. Of course, I'm your co-host, Big Waz, back in Los Angeles, California, and I'm joined by my brother on the west side of Los Angeles. What's going on, Nando?
I'm just, you know, warming up, doing some exercises for your birthday party on Saturday.
Yes.
Doing a little detox, you know, pre.
It's needed because we're gonna go nuts on the west side this Saturday to celebrate my 36th birthday, which sounds crazy to say, but yes, I will be turning 36.
Danny Bester is very excited. He's like, can we show up together? I'm scared to show up alone.
I'm sure you'll be all right.
Yeah. It's all good. It's gonna be a great time. Looking forward to it. I love celebrating my birthday, bringing folks together, and doing that kind of thing. But today on the show, we want to talk about some things that are happening in world soccer, the transfer window. I just wanted to ask Nando about transfer culture, because as you guys know, I'm a soccer novice, and so the way they do things is so different than
everything they do is different than our established norms here in the States with our major sports. So I wanted to talk to Nando about that. Of course, we wanted to get into Tyre Nichols' services was today. We haven't really talked about it at all on the show. So wanted to give that a little bit of space. But first, man, you know, front page of my New York Times website, the Fed raises rates a quarter point and signals more hikes ahead, Nando. This shit has like real world implications. Obviously, these rates are being raised on individual, you know, wage earning Americans, but also like these these corporations who borrow absurd and obscene amount of money. And, you know, for so many years, basically since the Great Recession, could bank on having insanely low interest rates. I think that stuff is coming back to bite them. And I think that's where you see a lot of these like firings and big ass tech companies and, you know, even media conglomerates who, for whatever reason, they always think it's a good idea to carry this absurd debt. They're just like, hold on, these rates are actually increasing on us and it's not as cost prohibitive as it used to be. And like, yeah, this shit has real world implications. And, you know, we talked about it in the past, Nando, like these bad outcomes for people are by design. The Fed wants, quote unquote, people to feel the hurt.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's really wild. I mean, it's, you know, this is all in response to inflation. I mean, I'm sure everyone has heard inflation. It seems to have calmed down a little bit. Obviously, the big part of it was the Federal Reserve interest rate hike, last year. But they're raising it even more. The point of this is to what they call cool down the economy to lower the inflation. And it just seems like, I don't know, like you're cutting off the patient's leg in order to, like, you know what I mean? Like I can't think of the analogy, but you know, there's something akin to that where there was an inflation, like that's fairly obvious. The problem is that I think the diagnoses of why we had that inflation is always wrong. And we've talked about this on the show. I mean, I think the way the policymakers think it was is that easy money and then a lot of money being pumped into the system by COVID relief, right? The $1,400 checks, mm-hmm. the various unemployment benefits that were expanded during COVID, the loans to small businesses, and all, like just money pouring into the system, increased the money supply and raised the inflation. And that may have been a small part of it. But the other aspect that they don't really consider is that there was fucking COVID. And we've heard of the supply chain issues with China. And the supply, like, that to me is the clear real culprit of the inflation. And what they're doing by raising interest rates is, like, deliberately slowing down the economy, deliberately putting people out of work. I mean, you just look at around Hollywood, around media, around tech, around many, many sectors, layoffs all over the place. And it's a direct result of the interest rate hike. And that is by design. You know, there was a time where there was that time where workers felt like they had more power, they had more leverage, mm-hmm. They had more money in their pocket. They had the ability to say no to work, which raised their leverage and was raising wages. And that's something that they can't tolerate. They can't tolerate raising wages. They can't tolerate, more worker power. So they need a disciplinary mechanism. And that's what's going on with this interest rate hike.
So, which obviously begs the question, Nando, like, is the problem that there's too much money? Like, the problem is that workers are making too much money?
Well, that
is
a problem.
Essentially it?
That is a problem for owners.
Yeah, you know, of course.
For capital. They don't want workers making money. Like,
right.
That is the problem, you know? And who does the Fed serve, you know? Nominally, it serves the people, but
Right, like, because that... I'm glad you said that. Because the way they sell it is like, oh, look at your eggs, right? We're so worried about you. But if I'm making more money to cover the cost of the egg... then Who loses here? Oh, that's right. The people who hoard all the fucking money. It's so obvious, like, that equation of goods and services, the price of goods and services increase, but the wages of the workers also increase to cover that price. That seems like an economy that is working, yeah, in my opinion. I don't understand how you can look at it any other way. Again, of course, and you know, people being like, oh, it's not a zero-sum game, but it kind of is if, like, the percentage of the surplus value that's being generated that goes back to the worker goes up, that means it's going down for the freaking capitalists, right? For the freaking the owners, if you will. And so, yeah, this seems like the fix to a problem that doesn't really actually exist.
Yeah, no, it's 100% true. I mean, and again, I think, like, it's just incredibly callous and irresponsible. I mean, they tried this in the late 1970s and early 80s, induced a recession. It was incredibly painful for people. They raised interest rates like crazy. It's the one mechanism they know how to use. It's the one mechanism, by the way, that's outside of democratic control, right? Mm-hmm. Like, who voted for
Biden's that? Gonna be like, I can't. I mean, what do I do? I can't do anything can't about the Fed.
Can't touch it. Can't touch it. You know, like, and it's like, we can't do anything about it. We can't rally, you know, to in some democratic way to oppose this. Mm-hmm. It's completely apolitical, which is why you're seeing a lot of societies rely on their central bank more and more for policymaking. You know, as kind of democratic politics withers away, you know, they love that. They love that the Fed can just decide, like, you know, whatever it is, like 500 dudes at the Federal Reserve could just decide, oh, yeah, we're going to, like, just throw millions of people out of work. And what are they going to do about it? Nothing. They can't do anything about it. They literally can't do anything. What, are they going to vote us out? They can't vote us out. They can't do anything. Like, they can't do anything. There's nothing they can do. Even if they remove Biden, if they impeach Biden tomorrow, they're not going to do anything about it. You know, so... Right. It is just completely undemocratic and insane. So, I always find the conversations around the Fed and the sanctity of the Fed as a kind of, it's like independent institution free from politics. And I'm like, that's the problem. It's fucking free from politics.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And it's absolutely governing our lives,
so. Absolutely no accountability. And again, they raised it and they said we're gonna raise it again, because people haven't been adequately punished. They want to spank us on our collective tushes and make us learn the lessons. No, you don't deserve to make more money, guys. You guys got to be poor and suffer. Moving on from the Fed, like I said, first day of Black History Month here on the 1st when we record this podcast, even though it will drop February 2nd. Another thing I see on my New York Times is, you know, Kamala Harris, first female Black woman vice president ever, spoke at the services of Tyre Nichols, who was killed at the hands of police in Memphis, Tennessee. It was caught on camera. You know, you guys know the story by now. For a few weeks or however long it was, sorry, I don't remember how long it was, they kind of spent the time, the authorities over there, sort of seeding the ground, like, guys, yeah, there's a video that's going to come out. It's going to make people angry. It's very fucking horrible. You know, and this involved five Black cops, which, I mean, policing sort of always shows the problems with identity-based politics or thinking or representation-based politics. These cops are Black. They're not going to treat, you know, poor working-class Blacks any better just because they themselves are Black. There's an understanding institutionally that these people do not matter. Their voices will not be heard by anybody, and they're the riffraff. And so we will treat them as such. It doesn't matter that the cops are Black or not. Where it does matter, though, Nando, I think when a black cop does something, or I remember even, you know, when we had our brother Kang up here, or even when it was an Asian cop in East New York, Brooklyn, when he killed somebody, you're more likely to go down for it. The institution doesn't view black people any differently, whether it's blacks, Asians, or white cops, or what have you. However, you're more likely to take the fall, actually be charged with a crime, actually be put in jail.
That's wild.
When the perpetrators are black, for Shosky.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think, obviously, it was an absolutely horrifying thing, and just another reminder about the violent nature of American policing and the violent nature of American society. You know, we've had, like two mass shootings in California in the last couple weeks. I mean, these two things are not unrelated. And again, I think that is also a kind of under-discussed issue in terms of the violence of the police, is that America is a very violent society with a ton of guns. And, you know, if you're a police officer, you could, meaning, like, there's, it's not unreasonable to think someone might shoot and kill you at any given moment. Like,
yep,
it could happen because there's a ton of guns out there, and America is a very violent place. You know, like there's a huge focus on what they would call structural racism or white supremacy, and that's obviously part of it. But there's other kind of under-discussed factors that play into the nature of American policing that are just completely under-discussed. I mean, I mentioned the violence issue, but also just the class issue. You know, like the cops kill a bunch of white people too.
They kill a lot of white people. All of them are poor as shit.
Yeah, and that's the thing. What they do kill is poor people. They don't kill a lot of rich, you know, people of any color. And you know, the sort of focus on race of the issue, and I understand why, but from an analytical perspective, but also from a kind of political perspective, seems to open you up to this kind of thing. It's like, well, look, the cops were black. Like the right wing argument right now with the Tyree death is like, oh, look, the cops are black. America's not racist. You know, like
even black cops do it. Duh.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously, like, they haven't seen Don't Be a Menace to South Central while drinking juice in the hood. Like, they already addressed this issue with the Bernie Mac character. You know, yep. Like, I hate your black gums.
Yeah.
You know, like, I hate everything about, you know, like, but. You know, that's obviously a caricature, but there is a point there. It's like, okay, like if it's a purely a race issue, then what's going on here? And it's like, yes, you can talk about like internalized racism, whatever, you know, or like institutional racism and things like that. But you know, there is this kind of under discussed vector of class. And I remember the video of like the white guy shot by cops in that hotel hallway that was just like absolutely insane. And you know, I'm not saying like, well, what about the white people? That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that like there is the huge part of the violent policing question in America has to do with the class disparity in America, mm-hmm. and the clusters of poverty, which is again also where a lot of the violence in America is. Mm-hmm. Black, Latino, white, whatever. If there is a cluster of concentrated poverty, obviously, like, you know, a lot of black neighborhoods have like a overrepresentation of that, but anywhere that exists, there's going to be violence, there's going to be over policing, there's going to be violent policing, and there's going to be deaths, both by, you know, from crime, but also from the police. And it's one of those issues that, you know, it, like the boring old kind of left-wing socialist arguments of, yeah, you gotta like reduce the inequality in this society, you gotta give people stable jobs, you got to give mm-hmm. people a decent standard of living, you got to give yep. people a decent kind of say in their lives and ability to have you know, the you know, some sort of hope in their lives. Like, that stuff would reduce this kind of thing dramatically. I mean, there's still a bunch of guns out there, which is a huge problem, and again, it's a thornier, more difficult issue to solve than people give credit to, just given the sheer amount of guns that there are out there. But you got to address these issues at their core, and there's a focus on police reform, and there absolutely should be several police reforms. But you know, as like Jacobin pointed out in this case, many of, like this, I'm quoting now from Bronco's piece, like many of the liberal reform efforts put forward as a solution were already in place in Memphis when Nichols was killed. Memphis had banned chokeholds and no-knock raids. Its police department had put in place mandates for de-escalation and intervention by fellow officers in cases of brutality. It's had training for implicit bias and cultural awareness in place for some time. And the cops that beat him to death were all wearing body cameras. You know, like, these things, like, aren't, these are band-aids over the sort of central issue, over the larger wound, which is a class society that is horribly unequal. America is the richest country on earth, but with clusters of poverty that are, you know, at the rates of some of the poorer countries in the hemisphere, in the world, like where other societies just don't have this level of concentrated poverty the way America has. And, you know, until we kind of address those issues, these kind of things are still going to happen.
Yeah. And I do, and I can hear, you know, a certain, kind of black person hearing the sort of I guess approach that we're taking to this issue and be like, yeah, that's all fine and good, but when you are black, and you know, if we're gonna paint this as structural class issues, blackness is sort of used as the tip of the spear, right? It's the main cudgel that's used to enact all of this stuff. Right. It's how you get these policies that fuck up white people, give them terrible health care, no government aid, no, like, you know, standard of living trash. It's the kind of that, like, blackness is how you deliver those policies and sell those policies to white people. Right. And, you know, policing and brutalizing blackness is how you prove that you mean business about those policies, right? And so if when you're black and you're just like, well, in the meantime, I have to be black and disproportionately deal with this, I understand that that frustration, that hurt, that anger. I understand that. But, you know, like anything else, because, like, you know, when you talk to a lot of black people, because amongst my friends, I'm like the weirdo, you know, commie scumbag idiot who wants everybody to be poor and not wearing deodorant on a commune somewhere. It's this idea that, like, they feel like all of the wrongs that happen are connected to an ancient and deeper wrong that is slavery, right? So people feel connected to a through line of oppression that dates back to quote unquote America's original sin. And what I tell every single black person is that I don't deny the role of race in our oppression. I just think it's just an incomplete analysis of it. You know, the idea that white people enslaved us because they're this special kind of evil people with this special evil gene that God gave them, or Dr. Yacoub or whoever gave them, ignores the fact that slavery was incredibly profitable.
Hello, listener. Have you ever used ButcherBox? I don't know if you know this about me, but I used to be a butcher. I used to work at an unnamed grocery store. I used to be that tall man behind the counter in your neighborhood, cutting up meat and preparing seafood for you. And I know that it can be a stressful situation. I know that it can be crowded. You have to wait your turn. You have to know what you want. You feel rushed. Sometimes you might think that your butcher has a bad attitude. I don't know. Happened to a friend. Couldn't possibly be me. But that's why I love ButcherBox. ButcherBox brings you peace of mind. You can easily find high quality beef, chicken, pork that you can trust is humanely raised. There's no antibiotics or added hormones. There's the ultimate convenience of not having to deal with butchers or the crowded meat counter after a long day at work. It's delivered right to your doorstep. There's always free shipping, and there's incredible value. You're getting really high quality products at an amazing value. You get exclusive member deals, you get recipe inspiration, guides, hacks. A little hack from my butcher experience, the petite top sirloin, which is about half the price of the New York steak, is a very similar cut with a fat cap on one side, and you get very good tenderness out of the petite sirloin. If you've ever been to a Brazilian steakhouse and you see them talking about picanha, that's the petite sirloin. With ButcherBox, I'm always prepared. I always have meat on deck for a grill and chill, a cookout, or just making dinner at home. And I'm saving a ton of money from shopping at the grocery store all the time. Now, I know what you're thinking. That's great, but what's my reward for signing up for ButcherBox? Well, I'm glad you asked, because if you sign up at ButcherBox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, you will get free ground beef for life. For life. Enough ground beef to fill the Nile, plus $20 off your first box. That's ButcherBox.com/dings.
Hey, listener, Zach Harper here from Cinephobe. Yeah, that podcast. It's a good one. Ascertain. Telling you right now, Prize Picks. That's the way to go. Prize Picks is America's number one fantasy sports app with over 3 million members. The easiest and most exciting way to play DFS is just you against the numbers. You pick more than or less than on 2 to 6 player stat projections and watch the winnings roll in. It's demon time. That's right. You're asking, what does that mean? It's demon time. I'll tell you. Demons and Goblins, the newest and most exciting way to play at Prize Picks. Squares marked with red demons or green goblins get you different payouts. You can now win up to 100 times your money with as little as 4 correct picks. That's insane. That's insane of Prize Picks to do. You know what else is insane? They offer injury insurance so that your entries stay in play, even if one of your players gets injured. For football and basketball games, if you have a player who exits the game in the first half and does not return in the second, that player projection won't count against you, and the rest of your entry stays alive. Prize Picks is the only DFS platform with an injury insurance policy. And by the way, they now offer Apple Pay for quick and easy deposits into your account. This football, basketball, any season you're playing. Me personally, I'm taking more than points on Joel Embiid all the time. I'm taking more than assists on Tyrese Halliburton. I'm taking less than points on Jordan Poole. Those seem to be the easy money makers for you. And you're probably wondering, Zach, how do I get involved in this? You go to prizepicks.com/ding and use code DING, D-I-N-G, for a first deposit match up to $100. That's prizepicks.com/ding. Use code DING, D-I-N-G, for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, pick more, pick less. It's that easy.
That shit made a lot of money. You know, that the making of the money came first. Then came racism and justifying it, and maybe these people are half human, and maybe they're this, and who knows, you know, the Negro actually likes this, and blah blah blah, all of those justifications and horrible things, awfulness, the awful oppression come after the fact that the shit was extremely profitable, right? Which gets at everything, you know, material issues, period. That's what it boils down to. And to me, to my mind, if even from the exception of it, the source of it is profit making, I don't see that disconnected to the issues that we as Black people face today. I think it's more of the same shit. Race is used as a tool to further advance the cause of profits over literally every fucking thing else, right? Yeah. And how we justified it is these defective people and their defective culture, and look at how they live, and blah, 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 blah. Of course we should be killing them, blah, 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 blah. By the way, you should be fucking grateful that you're not Black, poor white person. And we keep it pushing. Don't think about nothing else, you know? And in a lot of ways, man, and I'm not the first person to make this point, we make so much fun of representation politics, right? And how stupid it is to get hyped about Kamala Harris, or to get hyped about the, you know, Secretary of Defense, the Black dude, Lloyd, whatever his name is.
Yeah, Austin.
who literally gets plucked from the board of Raytheon. you know, the first people who were practicing this type of politics was white people. It's literally what they gave to the poor whites was like, no, look, the white man still gets to be in charge. By proxy, so do you. It doesn't matter that your standard of living is shit. Like, but guess what? White people have finally woken up to the con of that. And they don't give a fuck about that shit no more. They really don't. They're done with it. And, you know, I long for the day when black people sort of, and, you know, this is Black History Month, we sort of move past this idea of these great black individuals and what it means for the race and redeeming the race and get to the brass tacks of, you know, we need to collectively come together with the people that have a common interest and goal with us in making everything better.
What you just described earlier, and someone should clip it and like send it to students of political economy, is Marx's theory of around like the base and superstructure and how culture gets reproduced, right? Like, I mean, what Marx says is that like what he calls the base is, you know, basically the economic underpinnings of a society, how a society is organized economically, right? That's the base. And then the superstructure is built on top of the base. That is, you know, literature, religion, the laws of the country or the society or whatever. All of what we would call kind of culture is built on top of the economic superstructure of like the economic underpinnings of society. They both reinforce each other. The superstructure is there to reinforce that economic structure.
Period.
And then the economic structure reinforces that culture. And it's a
beautiful cycle. Yep.
And, and until you break that, which is very difficult to do, and it happens usually through some exogenous shock like a plague or a, you know, some natural disaster or an ice age or whatever, some major thing kind of upsets that thing. That is a very difficult cycle to break. But that's what it is. It's like, you know, the society reflects how it is organized economically. And that's the Marx theory about the base and the superstructure kind of explained beautifully.
Yeah, what Nando's talking about here is, like, what is Nando talking about? Like, for instance, something like this concept that the free market is tied to liberty and freedom, right? Like, this idea that unabashed capitalism is the basis of human liberty. Which makes no fucking sense, but it is baked into everything you see. It's like, we are free because of this thing. And it only benefits the people who are practicing in that for everybody else to think that. It's not as if you, on the individual level, get to practice, you know, unabashed capitalism. You go to work, you toil, and you earn a fucking check. Okay, yeah. But yet you think this system is producing the most incredible freedom that's ever imagined. And again, like that idea gets implanted in us so that we think that like the undergirding system is just supposed to be. It's just so, isn't it so beautiful? Isn't it so free? Isn't it so amazing when the reality is our fucking betters are absolutely crushing us? And, you know, the people at the very bottom of our system are not even just getting crushed. They're getting ground into powder, bro. It is awful what we're doing to the people at the very bottom of our system. You know what I mean? And so, yeah, I just wish people would have a better understanding of that. And I think we'd be better attack a lot of our issues that way.
Yeah. All right. Really quickly, you want to talk about Cancelo?
Yes. I want to talk about Cancelo because, you know, I read the story in The Athletic. Shouts to my man, Sam Lee. I'm listening, you know, various soccer podcasts that I listen to or whatever. And, you know, it's this idea that Cancelo, he doesn't like the way Pep uses him. Essentially, he wants to play every single game, basically every single minute. And when he's not, he's an extremely unpleasant person to work with. And Pep is just like, yo, this dude is poisoning my fucking locker room. He's got the ear of management. Like, they love the guy and they believe in his vision for the team. And so they basically shipped his ass to Bayern Munich. He's on loan, quote unquote. However, he's never coming back to Man City. Man. That bridge is crossed. It's over. And done. And it just got me thinking about transfer culture in football, Nando, because okay, so in the NBA, for instance, right? You will just be traded to whatever team. It doesn't matter. Like, if you are an important player, yeah. here's how the NBA basically works. If you are important enough, in so much that your salary is X percentage amount of what, you know, in American sports we call a salary cap. You know, let's just take Dame Lillard, for instance. Dame Lillard makes $60 million a year. I think the cap is at like 110, 115, whatever it is. But like, as a percentage of the cap, like, he is so important. And if a guy who's taken up a huge chunk of the allotment you have to pay players to make you good, his sort of spiritual and emotional well-being matters. Because if he's not playing his best, if he's sullying, if he's muddying up the waters around the team, and you cannot function because he's so important. And so, like, something needs to be done. Now, a dude on the bench sulking who makes $3 million or is on a minimum deal, and he starts going like, boo-hoo, you don't affect the winning. Getting rid of you wouldn't cost that much money. Like, we don't have to deal with you. So Dame Lillard has a say in who acquires him. You know, he can make threats about not being a happy camper when he's acquired. But, like, he has a say. Portland ultimately can just trade him, and the team that acquires him deal with the consequences. But, like, there's a sort of give and take where a team that's sort of allocating all of these resources in order to bring in a guy as great and as expensive as Dame Lillard, they need to have some kind of assurances that he's going to play ball. Because he gets paid so much, he's so important, he's so influential, they got to do that. A dude who's kind of a $15 million player, like, bro, you show up and you do what you're told no matter where they send your ass. There's no say in it, right? And that's basically the overall structure of American sports and the movement of players, not involving just a guy's contract is up, another team has the money to spend on his new deal, and then he goes. In soccer, it just feels a little different. What is the culture? What is it like? Well, what does it mean to move a guy, and how does it happen?
The biggest difference in soccer is that if you have a contract with a team and you're the third string goalie and you've never fucking play and half the fans don't even know you exist, the team can't move you if you don't want to.
Wow.
Everyone has total power as to where they move, when they move. Obviously, like, if you're out of a contract, then you're a free agent, and then the team can kick you, you know, right. They don't have to re-sign you or whatever. But, like, if you sign a five-year deal for X amount, like, unless you do something to be in breach, you know, like something egregious to be in breach, you can just show up to training every day and do your thing, and, you know, and you...
So basically, like... Man City couldn't just tell João Cancelo, yo, we're sending you on loan to the Minnesota Timbers or whatever the MLS team is in the cold. Like, it just can't happen.
No.
Cancelo has to
they have to give him a nice situation at Bayern Munich, a fucking top team that competes for the Champions League. And he's like, okay, yeah. Like, I'm mad at Guardiola. He's mad at me. Find me a team. Or, like, sometimes his agent will find a team. And if he likes the situation, then he'll go. But if they were like, we can't find anyone for you, or we can't find a situation that you're happy with, he could stay. You know, they can't kick him out. They cannot. The contracts are ironclad guaranteed. You know, like, Real Madrid has like two or three guys on their team right now who are just collecting a paycheck. I mean, just as like their backup striker, Mariano, it's like notorious, man. He's like, they try to ship him out every summer and he's like, nope. And they can't do anything. Some fucking guy no one's ever heard of, you know? He's been on the team for like 5 years because they gave him this long contract. It was like a huge mistake. And he's like, I'm not going to make as much money at another team. I like living in Madrid. I like being on the team. You know, I like being on the team that wins and shit, even if I don't play that much. I'm staying. And he's out of a contract this year and everyone's going to like celebrate. But, you know, he was able to stick it out. And so – every single player in soccer has the equivalent of, like, I guess, like a no trade clause or whatever. Like, and trades happen. Trades are exceedingly rare in soccer. Like, it's very rare that a player gets traded for another player. It's usually they get sold for a fee, you know, and then the team uses whatever money, or, you know, they buy other players. Like, it's like an open market in that sense. Like, it's like a cash market rather than a player market. But yeah,
transfers are exactly the same. Not just the loan situation, but transfers are exactly the same.
The loan situation is usually done to, like, you know, for some sort of financial engineering reason.
But it's functionally no different than a transfer.
Depends. I mean, sometimes they'll do a loan. Like, if you're like a young player and you have promise and you're on Man City and you're never playing because you're not good enough to beat out Haaland or whatever, but they like you and they like your they might loan you out to
that you can go get experience somewhere else.
Yeah. But sometimes at the opposite end, they'll loan out a player that they don't really want on their team, you know, who isn't playing and he's maybe a veteran, and maybe some other team is desperate for a guy like, oh my God, my center forward got hurt. You have this veteran forward that doesn't play that much. Let us have him for the rest of the season and we'll pay the rest of his wages, you know, for that season or whatever, or part of them. Sometimes they play part of them or whatever. And sometimes teams will be like, okay, you can have him. But then he comes right back. This is like what they call a loan with an option to buy. I mean, it's functionally a transfer. They have they pre-bake in a price for the purchase, and when the loan is over at the end of the season, Bayern Munich has to trigger it. And it's remarkable. I mean, Cancelo is one of the best players in the world at his position.
You know, right. Like, it's like extremely skilled for somebody who's supposed to be more defensive minded.
Yeah, like a fullback. He's the modern fullback. He's essentially like, I got the skills of a midfielder. You know, playing defense on the wing, which is just like an increasingly important position. And he's got he's super versatile in that space. But, you know, apparently he's just kind of difficult to deal with when he's not happy. And Guardiola's like, you might as well be gone.
I have another question, and it's more towards like the sort of like, is it normal the way Pep manages the team in the sense that he's constantly taking dudes in and out of the lineup? Is that a normal thing across the board for most of the best teams?
I would say, relatively speaking, no. He definitely rotates more than most, and he definitely is always trying to do, you know, he's obsessive and he's always like, you know, this team attacks like really well through channel 13, you know, like when they're in transition, and like, I need this guy to, you know, and you know what I mean? So like, he's definitely more obsessed. There's like a more old school thing is like, you got your lineup, you know,
you play your 11 guys every single day. That's it.
If they're healthy, keep pushing, you know, like, you know, Pep does rotate more than most. I mean, honestly, it's one of the reasons why I think he's been so dominant in league play. Is that he keeps his players so the league is a marathon, right? Like it's game in and game out. You got to be regular. You got to beat the team in front of you, you know, no matter if they're good, bad, or mediocre. That's the beauty of a league play, is that every single game has stakes, right? But it maybe does hurt him in the Champions League. I mean, Madrid is notorious for doing poorly in the league, you know, generally speaking, and winning a bunch of Champions Leagues all the time, you know. And it's like, when you have this like kind of defined starting lineup, and you know, Pep Guardiola, like, famously, when he played in the Champions League final, was it against Liverpool? He played in the Champions League final a couple years ago, and he benched Rodri, the center midfielder, you know. It was like, he probably had some reason for it. It wasn't injury. It wasn't attitude. It was like
one of his best players he didn't play because he thought it was some tactical reason in the final, and they end up losing.
They lose, and it was like, watching the game, I remember thinking like, you know, I'd rather he would have been nice, you know. And,
yeah, because the reason why I asked this is because I'm like, yo, like, this guy seems to be really mad at Pep in the way he's managing his minutes and his time played and his starts or whatever. And I'm wondering, like, is he going to go to a team where they're just like, no, you just play every single day?
No, I mean, Bayern's not going to do that either. you know, but it's a new situation. Like the Bayern also is like a very modern team. They rotate, you know, like these days they have fucking like they put like sensors on these players, and like in training they can see if like their muscle fatigue is like hitting 15 minutes earlier than yesterday, and that means like they might be like ready for an injury. You know what I mean? They have like all manner of ways, like they have like these advanced kind of stats to tell if someone needs a rest. And, you know, obviously like some of the more competitive guys, they want to play every day. And you know, like Luka Modric is 37 and he wants to play every day. Obviously he's not like a dick about it, but he clearly is competitive and he wants to play every day. He says like, I'm better. I feel better and feel like when I'm just in the rhythm of playing every single game, you know, some guys need to rest. It's different for every player, and a smart coach can kind of manage that. It does seem like Cancelo's like a little insane about it.
that seems to be the general sense. Like people were trying to be like, the reporters were trying to be diplomatic, but they were like, you know, we talked to people at his previous clubs, like we talked to people at Juve, when he went to Man City, they were like, is he gonna like it over there? He's kind of a hothead about certain things, and playing time is one of those things. So yeah, I just wanted to get a better sense of, you know, the surrounding circumstances of the, you know, the transfer, because yeah, people felt like this shit came out of nowhere and were pretty shocked about the whole thing. And I just wanted to get a better understanding about transfer culture, as well as like, should this guy be playing in 15 matches? Is this like some outlier situation? Because, you know, like I think about, like, say, Golden State's offensive system, where Steve Kerr likes to do this egalitarian, everybody touches the ball finds energy. Because Steve Kerr himself was a role player. So he understands the value of having people who aren't Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, feel like they're involved in what you do. If you are, say, a star player and you walk into a situation like that and you are used to dominating the ball, you might not like that system. And guess what? It's not a very common one. So that's why I was just asking, like, is he just in, like, an uncommon situation? It's like, no, like, bro, you can't play every game. What the fuck? Oh, man. Anyway, that's our show for this week. Make sure you guys become a Patreon, patreon.com/countthedings. We will see you guys next week. Peace out.